Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Today's program begins with a suggestion that you might consider when you're planning your spring or summer vacation. It's about the Gilmore Car Museum over in Southwest Michigan, offering a look at all aspects of the automobile. The Gilmore Car Museum has something for everyone, from the most diehard car enthusiast to someone wanting to learn more about the historical impact of the automobile industry on the state of Michigan. The museum holds more than 400 vehicles and 500,000 items on a 90-acre campus in Hickory Corners, Michigan. And if you wonder where Hickory Corners is, it's not too far from Kalamazoo. There are 8 restored 19th century barns, several recreations of past auto dealerships, many other historical buildings, such as a 1930s Shell gas station, a small town train depot from the 1890s, and an authentic 1941 Silk City Diner where lunch is served. Finally, there are several independent partner auto museums on this site. The Cadillac LaSalle Club Museum, the Classic Car Club of America Museum, the H.H. Franklin Club Museum, the Lincoln Motor Car Heritage Museum, the Model A Ford Museum, the Museum of the Horseless Carriage, and last but not least, the Pierce Arrow Museum. Something for everyone. From old Model A cars to Corvettes and Cadillacs, the Gilmore Car Museum has just about all the car enthusiasts would want, including interactive displays for children and a collection of original automobile artwork and advertising. So, if you're interested in going to a place like this, you might contact the Gilmore Car Museum with the following web address. It's Gilmore, G-I-L-M-O-R-E, Car, C-A-R, Gilmore Car Museum.org. Happy travels. And now we'll pause for just a few moments while we get organized for the next section of the program. We're going to talk about desalination today. Amid a historic drought, could desalination be the answer to water shortages in California and in the Southwest? That's the question of the day. Drinking water from the sea. Well, why consider desalination? Along the Colorado River and its tributaries, climate change is spurring the worst drought in 1,200 years. The river's water flow has decreased by about 20% in the last 23 years, and this has endangered water supplies to about 40 million people in 7 states and to 5 million acres of agricultural land. The Bureau of Reclamation has asked the 7 states of Arizona, California, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming to consider how to cut their share of the river's water by up to 30% this year. In Arizona, drought is combining with a population boom to create particularly dire water shortages, limiting further development and leading Scottsdale, Arizona, to cut off water supplies to a neighboring community beyond its borders. Among the solutions that are under consideration, desalination, that is the process of removing salt from saline water, is emerging as a top contender. In December, Arizona's Water Finance Board advanced a proposal for a $5.5 billion desalination plant in Mexico's Sea of Cortez. After being desalinated, the water would be pumped 200 miles north in a pipeline which crossed the southern border to deliver water to the drought-stricken region. Well, you might ask, how does desalination work? Well, there are two kinds. In the Middle East, which produces almost half of the globe's desalinated water, plants use thermal desalination, in which heat creates water vapor, and that water vapor condenses into fresh water. But about 60% of the world's desalination plants use a different process, and that is membrane desalination. It's also known as reverse osmosis. In this process, salt is filtered out of the saline water when it's pushed through a semi-permeable membrane that has tiny pores. Well, where is desalination already happening? In the desert nations that have been relying on desalination for years, Saudi Arabia houses the world's largest desalination plant, which supplies about half its drinking water. And about 40% or more of the water in the United Arab Emirates is desalinated, as is about 60% of Qatar's water. In Israel, 5 plants desalinate water from the Mediterranean Sea, accounting for almost all of the country's tap water. In North Africa, nations are also looking at desalination to combat water scarcity. For example, Egypt hopes to build 17 new plants in the next 5 years, quadrupling its desalination capacity. And Morocco plans to open 6 new plants in Casablanca this year. Are there any of these plants in the U.S. at the present time? Yes, in California. California has 14 seawater plants and 23 plants for brackish water, which comes from sources like rivers and aqueducts that are less salty than seawater, but are still undrinkable without some treatment. The Carlsbad plant in San Diego is the largest in the Western Hemisphere, and it produces 10% of the city's drinking water. Desalination is a partial solution to water scarcity. And in the next 5 to maybe 10 years, you'll see more and more desalination plants. Well, that's the good news, but there is a downside to desalination. It has a major environmental impact. For every liter of drinking water, desalination produces over 1.5 liters of brine. And when released back into the sea, this highly saline byproduct can destroy marine life. A 2019 survey found that globally, desalination plants produce about 5 billion cubic feet of brine every day. Then there's the energy required to run these plants, which comes largely from fossil fuels, and it generates greenhouse gas emissions. Engineers plan to use more renewable energy in some future plants, but that will require additional construction costs and better battery technology. So there are good points about it, and there are some less favorable points. The Arizona plant, for example, is far from a done deal. Both the U.S. and Mexico need to approve the project. It's financed in part by Goldman Sachs. It's led by an Israeli company called ID Technologies. It has built desalination plants around the world. But the speed at which this plan is progressing has surprised members of the State Water Finance Board, a newly expanded group that had only met 3 times before its unanimous December vote to move forward with studying the project. And giving a green light to ID would require a commitment from Arizona to purchase the water for 100 years, even at times when it's not needed. The plan also needs to pass a federal environment review, and environmental activists say that they will fight it. This is something to keep our eye on in the coming months and in the next few years. Desalination. We'll be right back. Don't go away. We want you to be with us for the next part of the program. Look at some questions that have been sent in to the Smithsonian Museum in Washington. People wondering about things for a long time and unsure of the answers. So the Smithsonian experts try to help. And the first question was from Queens Village, New York. It is, why do we see the moon during the day, but not the sun at night? Well, by definition, night is the time when our side of the earth is facing away from the sun. That explains why we can't see the sun at night. But why do we sometimes see the moon in the daytime? The moon orbits the earth roughly once each month. For half a month, it is on the earth's daytime side, and it is visible for at least part of nearly every day during that time, especially for us in the northern summer. The difference is at night, even a sliver is easy to spot, as long as it's in our line of sight. So the moon isn't a feature specific to the night sky. If people think of it that way, that's only because darkness makes the moon much easier to observe. And then this question. It comes from Los Altos, California. The question is, I still see the term American Indian in use, including in the title of a Smithsonian museum. Why not say Native American instead? Well, Native people prefer to be identified with their own specific tribe or tribes. But when it comes to describing all of these nations with one term, there's no consensus. Groups in Alaska like to be called Alaska Natives, while those in Canada prefer the term First Nations. Some others in South America call themselves Amerindian. Even though the term Indian originally came from a misunderstanding, many tribal people still prefer it over the alternatives. Some point out that any person born in the Americas could be called a Native American. Personally, the expert at the Smithsonian says, American Indian, because it is the language of the law between the tribal and federal government. And finally, the last question of the day. This comes from Honolulu, Hawaii. Why don't marine animals die from drinking seawater the way people do? Animals such as seabirds, sea turtles, and fish have adaptations that allow them to remove the salt from their systems. In non-marine animals, drinking seawater leads to dehydration and ultimately death, because the kidneys have to use even more water to flush out seawater's excess in salt. Marine mammals avoid this fate by getting water through their food. Some also have special adaptations in their kidneys to help them purge salt much more efficiently. And ingesting a bit of salt water through an accidental gulp produces no real harmful effects. And those are the questions to the Smithsonian for this week. We still have some information for you in the next segment. Thanks again for tuning in to 101.5 on your FM dial. We wish to give you entertainment, information, and once in a while, make you smile. Be right back. Now we're going to untangle the alphabet. A curious new find has discovered clues to the mystery of the first writing. The knotty question of the origins of our alphabet has been partly straightened out by the discovery of a comb. In June 2016, a group of archaeologists, the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, uncovered what was initially misidentified as a small bone. But on closer inspection, a zoo archaeologist surmised the object was indeed an ivory comb, though the teeth had been broken off. Microscopic examination revealed the fossilized remains of lice, and it confirmed their theory that this was indeed a comb. And two experts verified that the comb, which is almost an inch long, is made of ivory, so it must have been an import because there were no elephants in this part of the Middle East, in Canaan. But the comb's true significance wouldn't become apparent until Hebrew University discovered 17 faintly inscribed characters on it and translated the inscription, which said, "May this tusk root out the lice of the hair and the beard." Researchers estimate that the comb dates from 1700 BC, making this humble statement the oldest known complete sentence written in a Canaanite script. Previously, we had only fragments from this period. While the history of the development of the modern alphabet remains quite opaque in a very frustrating way, the Canaanite writing system generally is agreed to have emerged between 1900 and 1400 BC, and it offered a clear improvement in user-friendliness compared with earlier pictorial scripts, such as cuneiform and hieroglyphics. With their simple association between a character and a specific sound, Canaanite writing proved the basis for which modern alphabets evolved. And finding a complete Canaanite sentence is one of the most important discoveries that has been made in recent years. This is a landmark in the evolution of the alphabet. And with that, we're thinking about heading toward the end of today's program. We have a number of interesting topics for you in programs to come. One thing we'll be talking about is school buses, the evolution of the school bus. We have to go back to 1852 in Massachusetts, where a law was passed for compulsory education. And by 1900, 31 other states had similar requirements. But there was a problem. If the state was going to mandate the children attend school, kids would have to get there. And that's the reason that we're going to be talking about the evolution of school buses. Also, we're going to be talking about people being lured to the Amazon for decades, where rural workers are now fighting for the rule of law, and we're still waiting for the opportunity to talk about Frederick Jackson Turner and his frontier thesis. That would be kind of a long subject, and it might even be in two parts. So if you're a history buff, I think you'll enjoy that. So now it's time to think about leaving. Sorry to do that. The end of the program is always a little bit sad, at least for me. But we have to leave you for another time and hope that you'll come back, that you'll stay safe, be well, be kind to others. And Willie Nelson and I are going to leave you with our song for every program as we go down the road again, looking for items to include in a little of this, a little of that. We hope you enjoyed today's show, but we certainly enjoyed giving it to you. For that, be good. We'll see you soon. Best friend.